Hi there, and welcome to this very special episode of A-Minder. We're doing something a bit different today than our usual updates on the latest Alzheimer's disease research. Today's episode is a conversation that we had with some of the creators of the online magazine neuropsyched.ca. Sarah Luady, external manager here at A-Minder, joined me, Ellen Kosh, in talking to Jen Kim and Lucy Aceves from the Neuropsyched magazine. And now we're sharing this conversation with you. We talk about all things grad school and academia, from useful tips for choosing a PI, our experiences of grad school during the pandemic, financial barriers, and establishing boundaries in grad school. We also talk about Neuropsyched magazine and what working in science communication means to all of us. I really enjoyed talking to these women, hearing about their unique experiences, and learning so much along the way. I hope that you enjoy listening too, and if you want to join the conversation, reach out to us on our social media pages or by email after the show. We'd love to hear what you think about the episode. If you have anything to add that you'd like to share with us, we would love to hear from you. All of the topics that we cover are also broken down in the show notes, so if there's a particular topic you really want to skip ahead to, you can use the timestamps there to jump to that part of the episode. All right, so without further ado, let's get right into our conversation with Jen and Lucy from Neuropsyched. Enjoy!
Welcome to A-Minder, a podcast where we summarize the latest publications on Alzheimer's disease for you, so you can spend more time doing awesome research. For every month, you'll find a series of episodes by theme, and each comes with a bibliography. Whether you're in the lab, on the bus, or cooking your meal, we hope you find this podcast useful and accessible.
Hi, listeners. Welcome to a special episode of A-Minder. We'll be talking with a couple of our colleagues who run the Neuropsyched online magazine. You may remember my voice from other A-Minder episodes. I'm Ellen, one of the co-founders of the podcast and the internal production manager. And I'm also a PhD student at UBC in Lynn Raymond's lab, studying Huntington's disease pathology. And I'm here with Sarah from the podcast.
Hi, everyone. Yes, it's really good to be on the air again. Sarah, currently second year in medical school, one of the other co-founders of A-Minder and the external manager. I did my master's in the Neil Cashman lab at the University of British Columbia, which is where I met Ellen a couple years ago, like you said earlier. Feels like ages now.
Yeah, it feels like so long ago. It was pre-COVID, so everything from back then feels like a long time ago. And so joining us today, we have Lucy and Jen from Neuropsyched magazine. So Lucy, do you want to introduce yourself first?
Hi, everyone. I'm Lucy. I am a fourth-year PhD student, and along with Jen and four other folks, I'm one of the co-founders of Neuropsyched, and I'm so excited to be here.
Awesome. And then we also have Jen here.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for having us on the air today. I'm excited to be here. I'm one of Neuropsyched's co-founders and the current website designer. And I'm doing my neuroscience PhD at UBC also in Dr. Annie Cernia's lab, studying microglial immune memory in the brain.
Awesome. Well, we're really excited to have you here and to be doing something a little bit different with you two from our regular A-Minder routine. So Sarah and I invited Jen and Lucy to the show to talk about overall the grad school experience, because all of us are at different stages of our careers. Some of us are doing our PhDs early-ish on, like in the case of Jen, and Lucy and I are later on in our degrees. And then Sarah's in med school and she's finished her master's degree. So we wanted to talk about the grad school experience, the ups and the downs and everything in between. And we're also really big on science communication. So you'll hear us talk about that later on in the show as well. To get started for a little icebreaker here, we're going to be talking all about grad school. So why don't we start by thinking of one word to describe your grad school experience so far or in the past? So I'll go first. So the one word that I picked is a roller coaster, because there's, as I kind of mentioned before, there's been a lot of ups and downs. There's been really great times, like after I finished my comp and I survived it, and also really hard times, like when I was really stressed out studying for my comp, or other times, you know, really long nights, but also really fun times as well, and all the great people that I've met. So that's my word. Who wants to go next?
For me, I think the word would be growth, because I feel it was also in the academic sense where I learned so much, but also as a person who have struggled so far, I've grown so much since I started my PhD.
Mine is done. And not only literally, but figuratively as well. I think this was also a big lesson I learned throughout graduate school, was not to be too focused on being perfect, but just getting things done. And I remember someone very wise told me, Sarah, there's no such thing as a perfect thesis. There's a done thesis. Because I was going to my third year, my master's, and I was so focused on trying to make this big story grow and grow and get to the end of it. But really, I was just going down a rabbit hole. And that taught me a big lesson, is to sometimes just focus on getting things done. It doesn't have to be 100% perfect. 70% sometimes gets the job done. So that's my word. How about you, Jen?
I'd say my word is unforgettable for both the highs as well as all the lows.
Well, it sounds like from what you're saying, there have been a lot of surprises along the way, things that you did not necessarily expect. So what would you say surprised you the most about grad school? Ellen, what surprised you?
I have a few different things that I didn't know going into grad school. So I guess I knew some things because I did an honors thesis and was quite involved with the lab before coming to grad school. So I kind of had a little bit of an idea of what research was like. But since starting grad school, some things that I didn't really expect is some of the skills that I've learned in the lab, like soldering wires together. I didn't expect to be doing that. I didn't even really know what soldering was before, really. And all the homemade building of equipment to save money a lot of the time, which is, I find it's really great. I don't know, you can kind of build things the way that you need them, and adds to like the independence and also collaborative, because I'm building things with other people in my lab. And then another thing I was thinking about is how I was really nervous at the start, and I still am kind of, but I was very nervous at the start about conferences and talking to other professors or talking to people from other labs. But it's actually very easy to make connections at places like conferences if you just talk to people and if you just talk to professors. Or I set up a collaboration just by emailing a professor, and it's really not that scary, and most professors are happy to hear from you. Or actually, one thing that works really well is talking to other students in other labs and making the connection that way. So that's another thing that's I've learned as I've gone through grad school that I wouldn't have thought was possible at the start. So what about you, Lucy?
Yeah, definitely. I think I will agree with you in the conference part. Like before starting grad school, I used to think professors were this super serious people that you had to make appointments with before being able to meet. But then the more you spend time in the lab and the more you talk to other professors, you realize that most of them want to talk to you, because at the end, they do benefit as well from having a relationship with other students, even if they're not in the same lab as like their lab. And I would like to add that it really surprised me the lack of structure in grad school. I imagine that I will start working in the lab, somebody's gonna give me like a list of to-do things, and then from there I could go and start my PhD and finish it quickly. And it's never like that in grad school. You have deadlines, and then those deadlines don't matter, and then sometimes they do. It's hard to navigate sometimes without knowing what's going on or what rules are actually important to follow.
Oh my gosh, can I jump in here? Because mine was very similar to yours, Lucy. Is I did not expect the amount of self-direction involved in grad school. When I started, I had been a volunteer in the lab, the same lab before, where I was told what to do. I would show up at 9 and someone would say, do this, clean that, whatever. And when I started as a graduate student, I didn't realize that I had to adjust to a new role, because that's what it is. It is a different role where you are the master of your day. You're the one who drives the project. And it took me many months to realize that, to stop asking for permission for everything. I started to, you know, ask more for forgiveness rather than permission. I didn't 100%. Realize that. Sorry?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say 100%. Sometimes you do things and it turns out that works, and you're like, remember that thing you told me not to do to your supervisor, and she or he will be like, okay, I guess it worked.
Yeah, totally. And even with ordering things, I wouldn't order anything without asking for permission. And at some point, I realized that I could just write it in the ordering book and it would arrive and I could start my experiment and finish it and no one would yell at me for it. So that was a huge step for me to just adapt to that new role. And once that started, my project went much faster. Because people are busy in the lab, and as much as they want to provide you with mentorship, they have their own projects and they're not there to think about your project for you. And I think for me, I felt like I gained more maybe respect and attention from my PI once I started doing that and going to him and say, I did this, I did this. Mm-hmm. This is what I think we should do next, rather than ask him, hey, what should I do now? And that's what it comes to at the end, to be a grad student, to learn to manage a project. So that's what surprised me the most, I would say. How about you, Jen? I see you nodding.
Yeah, I agree with what all of you guys said. Something that I found very surprising about grad school that's a little bit different from what y'all said was how important and critical it is to actually have a strong support system that sort of carries you through grad school, because it's really, really challenging and difficult at times. But I think it's also really hard to find and make those connections and maintain them through your grad school journey. And I think once you find your people, though, it really is the best thing ever. And it's probably, honestly, the biggest reason that I even survived these past 2 years of grad school. And I think that's super important and not stressed enough.
Yeah, and you just started. So it's so, like, I find that's impressive that you already realized that at the beginning of your journey.
Yeah, I mean, without a support system, you can sort of trek through and make it through, but I think it just makes the experience so much more enjoyable and memorable to go through it with your peers. But again, I think it's very challenging to actually find those peers and find people that you click with and can trust and talk to and lean on to get you through all the ups and downs.
And you started when it was pre-COVID, so you actually did get to meet your like the other students.
Yeah, that makes it way easier. And honestly, so much respect for people starting graduate school during COVID.
Yeah.
I know it must be like 10 times more challenging. Mm-hmm. Especially if you can't see your peers in person.
Yeah, definitely. It's really hard to make those connections virtually. Mm-hmm. I don't think I'd be able to. Yeah, COVID caused a lot of problems in general, I think, for everybody, probably around the world in grad school. For me, one thing, like, it really basically put my research behind by like a year. I don't know about you guys. I'd like to hear from you too, like how it affected your research. It was like starting from scratch a few months later after all the research was shut down and then, you know, only slowly starting up. And now finally, like tomorrow, actually on the day after we record this, things are really starting to get back to almost normal. With the restrictions here. So that's exciting. But yeah, it's been a struggle. And then working from home was also really hard to start for me as well. But now I feel like I have a good flow for it. That took me a whole more than a year to get to that. But finally, I got a good homework flow. But yeah, enough about me. So what about you guys? How did research, so Lucy and Jen, who are both in research currently, how did it affect your projects?
I think, yeah, 100%, just like you, I just learned how to work from home. And now I can come back to the lab, but I feel kind of guilty because really COVID didn't affect my research. Mm. By the time COVID hit, all my data was collected. So really the thing that affected my research the most was me. Like trying to work from home, learn how to spend 4 hours on my own and still be very productive. I think that was the biggest struggle. And as I said, and as I've said it before, I don't know if this is just an excuse to myself and an excuse I keep making towards my work. Because, you know, we all, especially in grad school, we have like this idea that you have to be productive no matter what. And you have to bring results no matter what. So when everybody else, like Ellen, for example, that cannot collect data and they're behind, compared to me, who has everything ready to go, and I'm the one who's also not making progress, that's kind of frustrating, I guess. And it's like the frustration is towards myself. So how do you deal with that? And it's been mostly that struggle, I think. Yeah. How about you, Ben?
Yeah, I think I was a little bit more fortunate in the sense that, yes, at least within our lab, the research was definitely impacted, but not to the point where I had to halt it completely, because we were still able to come in with limited capacity, and we're kind of a growing lab, so we have less personnel. But I do think that having gone through 15 months of this, maybe at the start, if I'm being completely honest, I sort of relished in the flexibility and freedom of just having a little bit more control over my day. But then towards the end of it, aka like now, it sort of really wore me out. And I think in the long run, probably the most challenging thing for me personally was the accumulation of all the little things that I didn't really realize were huge motivators of my day-to-day prior to the pandemic. So all the little things and rewards, like coffee breaks with friends and just like chatting with people in the hallway, bumping into them, seeing peers at different like weekly journal clubs and group meetings. And also a big one was looking forward to conferences and trips and things to go see my family and sort of marking off the calendar dates, you know, in anticipation of that. Maybe I should mention here that I also haven't seen my family in almost a year and a half now. So that's been pretty challenging as well.
Wow.
So anyway, without all of these milestones, both small and big, to work towards, every day has sort of just felt very like monotonous. I think that really starts to chip away at you over time. Maybe you don't realize it on a day-to-day basis, but I think reflecting back on the past 15 months, I'm starting to realize how much of a toll it's really taken. But I'm glad that things are starting, at least in British Columbia, to return to a version of normal.
Jen, you bring up some really interesting things, because yeah, when we think about research and COVID, there are things that are really out in the open that come to mind, like animals and deadlines and data. But there are hidden things that are also as important. Like, researchers have other identities as well. We're people. And yeah, like I was still a technician in the lab at the time, and I really relished in being able to stay home, not having to travel to the lab, and just focus on data analysis, reading. I thought that was the time I was going to catch up on my writing and everything. But then that came with its own challenges that you don't really see in the lab, like sharing space with your partner or your roommate. And like when everyone works at home, if you do not have the space, that can pose challenges on life-work balance or the boundaries that you want to establish with your work. And I think like every graduate student probably has their own set of personal challenges, like not being able to see their family. Some people may have dependents at home, so really working at home may not be a good option. Well, for others, that's really welcomed. But I think, yeah, it's very important to think of our other parts of our life that sometimes are neglected in academia. Like, we're not just researchers or graduate students. Our mental health is also important. If you're not in that state of mind, you cannot be creative. You cannot be motivated to come up with new experimental plans or new ideas. And the other thing you mentioned that I heard from other students as well is connection with peers, like those coffee meetings and all. I would think that for someone who was starting, seeking that mentorship or advice from peers on small questions, and Lucy and I, before recording, spoke a bit about that, like asking silly questions, like you would ask that from your peer in the lab, but you don't want to write an email about it when you're home. So I would think that probably was really tough for new graduate students or those students who don't have those connections and need a bit of mentorship or support. What do you think, Ellen?
I agree with all the different points that were brought up. And I am just currently thinking about that, the coffee breaks and talking with lab mates. And we used to have a lab office with five of us in it. It was really small and all five of us were crammed in there. And we'd always be talking all the time about research and random things. And we make a lot of really good conversations too, that helped with the project, or ideas would come up that way. It's funny because we got like somebody had norovirus and gave it to like a few months before COVID, like we all got sick because we were all crammed in the office. So we'd always all get sick at the same time. So it's probably not the best to be crammed in there together. And I don't think it will happen again now post COVID.
Oh dear.
So that was something I really missed and we didn't have for so long with these, like we had Zoom meetings and then we were talking on Slack with our lab, but it's not the same. So it's nice that that's starting to come back a little bit now that more people are back at the lab. Finally, it's starting to feel like normalish when I'm there. One thing, you know, that is like a positive maybe, and Jen, you kind of mentioned this, like the freedom at the start that you felt. Like this one thing I really like is that now I feel like if I don't have a reason to go to the lab, I'm just going to stay at home and work from home, which was not really something I felt. Like the overall feeling I felt in our program was that you just go in every day. And I actually have to commute quite a long time now. So I'd rather stay at home, and I actually have a good, like I said, workflow at home now. So it's nice to not feel like you have to be there all the time physically. And there's a lot more flexibility in things that we used to do in person, we could probably do online now. And also talking to people across the world. Like we have a collaboration going with a lab in Pittsburgh. And I know we did do those things before, but it feels like it's opened up a bit more since COVID.
That's interesting, Alan. I remember asking from our listeners on social media if there was an expectation of them working from home and in the lab, if the restrictions were open up, would they work more from home than before? Or would they feel comfortable working from home? How was that like? Was there an expectation for you to be in the lab every day? And has that changed since the pandemic? Does anyone have any thoughts on this?
I think for me, it was very different. First, because I'm the only student in my lab. Right now, it's only me and another technician and a few of undergraduate students working with us, but in different projects. So to me, it never really makes sense to come to the lab unless I was working with animals, which didn't happen too often compared to people doing animal research. So I guess I would, now that it's even less necessary for me to come to the lab, I don't think I will return, because as Sarah mentioned, some of the nice things about being in the lab is talking to peers. But if you don't have peers, what's the point of coming to the lab, right? So I think that's a very big difference in my specific case compared to other students. Because even though I share lab space with other students, if they're not from your lab, and you're not doing work that is related to your work, it's harder to kind of break the ice and just be like, hey, random person, I'm sitting here. You want to go for coffee? That can be a bit intimidating. And because it was intimidating at the beginning, then I didn't do it as much. And those relationships never developed. So I never really had a good reason to come to the lab. And even less now that I don't work with animals anymore. I'm just analyzing data.
Yeah. I think that comfort definitely comes with time. When I was an undergrad, when I was volunteering, I felt like I had to know everything when I was in the lab. And I think it was that camaraderie that we built throughout times, like through hanging out over coffee in the morning with my lab mates. I felt like, oh, this very smart postdoc, I can ask them about how I'm going to hold the pipette for this experiment or any, like, you know, why is it that this is not working? And I thought that made a huge difference in the workflow. But that takes time to build. And I think not everyone is fortunate enough to have those opportunities around them for mentorship beyond the PI. Because I think when we think of mentorship in academia, we often think about PIs or committees. Mm-hmm. But other PhD students and other people in the lab play a very big role. For me, I think they played an even bigger role than senior scientists. Like these PhD students around me who were in my shoes 2 or 3 years prior, I thought gave me very, very good piece of advice that, you know, for my PI who was far removed from graduate school, there are things that perhaps he couldn't really advise me on as much as these peers. And he was very aware of that. He made it very clear that I should turn to my peers in the lab for mentorship when I could.
Yeah, and I think it's really funny, or it's really interesting, Sarah, that you mentioned mentorship in that way, because I was just thinking that when people think of mentorship in grad school, you immediately think of your supervisor. And definitely your supervisor would be, or should be, in theory, the first and maybe even main mentor that you have. But yeah, there's relationships with peers that can be friendship, but in that friendship, it's also mentorship. Being able to ask somebody who's been in the lab 2 weeks longer than you, which key should I use? These tiny things, develop relationships that are beneficial for the mentor and for the mentee. And I think that as we walk into grad school, we are not as conscious about this type of relationships, and we might not put as much effort into building this relationship. And I think that's a big mistake that graduate students usually make, and not thinking about mentorship beyond people who are postdocs or their supervisor, but really their peers are great mentors because they're probably living the same things that they are. You can find mentors and mentees everywhere in the lab.
Yeah, I agree too with everything you're saying about that. I'm kind of interested to hear everybody. I feel like we're all from different types of labs. Like, well, me and Sarah, like both of us were from a lab of a senior professor who's also a clinician. So pretty busy, I think, and wasn't in the lab as much. But I still found in my lab, we have a good atmosphere of mentorship from everybody. Like she really, you know, we have lab meetings every week and everybody chimes in with their advice or questions, and she encourages people or even asks, oh, well, you know, blank also is doing a similar project. So what do you think? Like, even if they're just another PhD student, they're still a mentor. So I really agree with that. And I think that I'm lucky to have a really good supervisor that creates a really nice environment of helping each other. And it's very collaborative in my lab, as well as with some other labs at UBC. I don't feel shy to, you know, ask questions. And I feel like it didn't take me very long to get there because of the environment that the lab had. And I know that there's much more toxic lab environments, much like more competitive ones I've heard of, these labs that are all postdocs and very competitive. And so that seems crazy to me. And I'm hoping to not be in a lab like that ever. But yeah, so that really speaks to me. And I wanted to hear, because Sarah, so, yeah, you might have something to similar. I'm not sure, but I think you might have a similar experience in your lab. And then also Jen and Lucy have kind of different lab environments maybe than us. So
I'm glad you brought up that some labs do have a toxic environment, because I'm sure some of our listeners may be listening to us and say, oh, lucky you, but this is not what I don't have that in my lab. What do I do?
Yeah.
And I would say, like, I also found mentorship in other laboratories. Mm-hmm. So not everyone in my lab had experience or expertise with microscopy, for example. So when I didn't have that, you know, I didn't have anyone to ask, I built relationships with other laboratories around us. And it was also very helpful to hear from other people in other labs. Like, I spent 7 years in the same lab. For me, that's all I know. But talking openly with other people, I learned what was good and what was bad. Like, what are things that I could criticize in my lab, and what are things that I should, you know, be grateful for. So I would say, like, not shying away from connecting with other labs, mm-hmm. and seeking those opportunities elsewhere, even among your committee, talking to their labs or people in the lab. You know, if you're there late at night and someone passes by, just say hi, and that can take you a long way in terms of the friendship or mentorship. So I just want to, like, emphasize that not every lab reflects what we're talking about, and that's very unfortunate. What we're talking about may actually be an exception rather than a norm. I don't know.
Yeah, for me, I guess specifically talking about mentorship coming from my supervisor, I'm also one of the lucky ones. Like, I'm also very fortunate to have a supervisor. She is a bit of a senior supervisor. She's hoping to retire soon, and I'm kind of the one who's stopping her from retiring. So she has more time for me, and she really cares about my career development, whether it is in academia or not. And I know that this is something that other students have problems with, where they tell their supervisors, you know what, I don't want to do a postdoc, I don't want to go into a PhD, and that really kind of make the relation sour and difficult for students. And I guess what I would suggest people listening to us is that don't settle for a bad mentorship. If you feel your supervisor is not doing enough, one, maybe they don't know they're not doing enough. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to voice out your needs. And two, if after voicing them out, they didn't listen to you, look for mentorship elsewhere. And I'm not saying leave your lab, because that's a really big step to take, but there's always a way to find that mentorship relationship somewhere else. And if the relationship with your supervisor is really toxic, live in a lab, it's more common than I think everybody thinks. I think when you enter a lab, you think that leaving it is going to stain your career and that nobody else has done it. But generally, there's funds in universities and in programs for people switching labs, and there's a reason for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so similar to Lucy, I'm also very lucky in the sense and extremely grateful to have a supervisor who, at the end of the day, actually advocates for me and is genuinely invested in my growth as a scientist and also getting me to the next stage of my career. What's a little bit different than you guys is that my PI is a new PI. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually her first graduate student.
What?
Yeah. So in addition to her fabulous, you know, mentorship, she's also around a lot. So she's very involved and engaged in all of our research projects. Any working relationship, there have obviously been some challenges along the way. But I think one of the things that I admire most about her mentorship is her willingness to consider my perspective when we're addressing these difficult situations and sort of meet me in the middle and be able to come up with a compromise that works for both of us. And as a mentee, this makes me feel really respected and heard and sort of comfortable reaching out to her when I need to. This is something that I really aspire to and hope to cultivate in my own career. And honestly, something, again, that should be the norm, but unfortunately often isn't. And on top of that, it's so hard to gauge until you're actually working with the person. So this also, sort of circling back to Sarah's point, makes it super important to find mentors outside of your direct supervisor, and also just a network of peers and people, I don't know, like a level above you or two levels above you, to lean on outside of your direct supervisor, just because you never know and you really can't make that call that this person is a good mentor, however you define that, until you really spend some time working with them.
Wow. May I ask a question to build up on that? I'm wondering, Jen, because our PIs, like you said, Ellen, they're very different. We have clinician PIs, we have more established academic scientists, like people are more invested maybe in academia. And yours, Jen, is a new PI. I was wondering if you knew that when you joined the lab, and if you, what was your thought process when you picked your PI? And maybe everyone, did you choose your PI? Did you think about what kind of mentor you're looking for? Or did you just jump in without really thinking about this?
I can start. Yeah. So it was a bit of a risk, I'd say, for me, because there aren't any other former lab mates to sort of mm-hmm. ask questions about during the interviews. So I sort of had to trust my own gut and get a feel for how her mentorship would be like myself. So I came prepared to the interview with a specific list of questions, asking things like, what's your mentorship philosophy? And sort of, you know, getting a feel for it based off of how she's answering. And also, I actually forget who gave me this tip, but someone told me to ask how open she would be to letting me do an internship outside of academia if I wanted to, like during my tenure as a grad student. So I asked that, and she was very open to it. Whatever you need to sort of explore your options, I'll support it. I specifically asked, I want to try a summer internship in like biotech. How do you feel about that?
Wow.
So I think that was a really big sign that she would be a supportive mentor. So I think you just need to put some thought into what specific questions you ask in a situation like this when you're trying to scope out the advisor. So if anyone's interviewing soon or you're trying to reach out to people, just think about those things before you go into an interview. Just because the research is flashy or the facility is nice, like, doesn't mean that you're going to have the time of your life. Like, I think your relationship with your mentor is probably the most important. And I found out a lot of this advice on Twitter as well, looking through different threads like PhD chat and just like interview tips and sort of aggregating all of that together. So just ask around, look on Twitter, reach out to me if you want to, if you're in a similar situation.
I wish I was on Twitter before. I mean, not that I'm that active now, but I didn't do it. Those are really good questions. I didn't even think to ask anything like that to my supervisor. I feel like I just kind of, maybe I did just luck out. I'm starting to really think we've all kind of lucked out, because I just remembered something someone told me. Someone in our lab once said to me, and they'd been in many labs before, and they said it was a culture shock coming to this lab. And people, and she was, it was almost like, what's the catch? Like, you know, it was so surprising the way people were acting. So nice and not competitive. And yeah, hopefully more labs are becoming, you know, more collaborative and more supportive. But yeah, so I kind of got lucky that way. But I would really think that that list of questions would be a great resource. I'm wondering if we should even maybe make it available to listeners or something. I think that would be awesome to, or maybe we can share something on Twitter, like one of the links that you mentioned. Like maybe if you found it, we'd share it for listeners, because I think a lot of our listeners would be really interested in that. And even thinking for my postdoc, if I do want to do a postdoc after, I would love to have a list of questions.
I think that would be super useful, because definitely I had to look through lists and lists of different Twitter threads to find the questions to put them together. So if you can have them all in one place for someone who just referred it, that would be, I think, an amazing resource.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just impressed that you thought to ask questions, because when I joined, I was just so grateful they would take me. I thought like I couldn't be picky. I didn't even think of sampling for supervisors. And I mean, the first one I emailed was Neil, and I just like found his research on the BRC and it aligned with my interests. So I messaged him, he messaged me back, and his email back was so kind. I thought, oh, what a kind person. And then we met, and in the interview, I just felt like I clicked with his personality. And I was just very lucky that he was a clinician who loved his job in medicine. So when I told him that my plan was to apply to medical school, he was super encouraging and supportive. And he has been ever since throughout graduate school, where he knew that was my primary goal. And he didn't judge me for it. But I know some supervisors are very hesitant to take on students who are applying to medical school, because they think that they're not going to focus on as much on their academic career. So for me, I really lucked out that, you know, he and I just clicked and had similar values. And he was also not in the lab much. And that worked for me quite well, because it allowed me to just take things at my own pace. And he trusted me a lot, and I trusted him. I know for other grad students, they would prefer to have someone who's more involved and more present. And at the end of the day, when people ask what's the best supervisor, I'd say there's no best. There's just what clicks for you, what works for you. It's important to know what you need. So what's good for me might be a terrible choice for you. Although I would say there are some bad supervisors are bad across the across the board. There are some things just as bad for every student. But yeah, I'd be curious to hear. For you, Lucy, did you think before you applied? Or
I mean, I guess I thought of the research, but similar to you, Sarah, I was like, if anybody takes me, I'll say yes no matter what. Like, that's the thing, the first thing that I thought. And asking questions, how did you know this? Like, I think because coming from a different university in a different country, like, these are things that you don't know you can do. Like, I think also coming from not doing any research at all, like when I started my PhD, I didn't know you could ask questions, and I didn't know how important your relationship with your PI was and the weight that your supervisor had in your degree. Like, mm-hmm. all these things that when you're looking for a supervisor, you might not know. And if you guys, for our listeners, think who you choose, sometimes it's even more important the supervisor that you choose and the research that you do. If you have to choose between two supervisors, choose a better mentor 100% of the time.
The best advice I think I've received after I got in, like I've heard people talk about it with our undergrads who were looking into grad school, was to ask people who left the lab what it was like to work there, because that's where you get all the juicy gossip, where they don't feel like it's going to affect their career if they told you the truth of how things went. That I thought that was very good advice. But also talking to students who are there, just to know a bit about, you know, what's the culture like there? Do you have to be there 9 to 5? What are the expectations? What does a lab manager do? Is a lab manager there to solely manage administration, or are they there to manage projects? Who's managing the projects in the lab? These are all things that vary widely between laboratories.
That's a really good idea. Ask people who've left the lab. I'd never even thought of that.
Yeah.
I think another big thing that I realized in retrospect was how important finding a program that fits your interests and your needs is. I actually switched over to neuroscience halfway through my first year. Not for any like bad reasons or anything. It's just more because I felt that as someone coming from a like biopsych and neuroscience background, just my interest in general, with the specific questions being asked in my research and what I want to pursue later on, I felt that neuroscience was a better fit, and I felt a real sense of community within like the grad program in neuroscience. So I'm very happy that I switched over, and I think that that's really important too.
to sort of scope out your program during interviews and ask people about how supportive the program itself is. So not just like your lab environment, but your sort of work environment in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like I really missed out on that. I did my master's in experimental medicine. And funny enough, the day I got into neuroscience, I applied to XMed. Because all like most people in my lab were in XMed, and they're telling me about the course load in neuroscience, and they felt like XMed gave them more flexibility to do more research than coursework. And for me, I just wanted to focus on the research, and I felt like if I wanted to learn something, I will do it on my own time. But then I realized that for me in experimental medicine, we have people who are doing things on cancer and then autoimmune diseases, and then like we had nursing people who are nurses or med students in my program. So like there's a wide variety of projects where I didn't feel like there was much of a community, although the program was wonderful. I don't regret it. But I would look at my peers in neuroscience, I'd be a little jealous of that community they had. But something else that like you could do neuroscience research without being in a neuroscience program. So I did meet people in biochemistry and cell biology who did neuroscience. And it somehow felt like we're a bit fragmented that way, like especially if you're doing Alzheimer's research, you're not necessarily in neuroscience. But that community, oh man, that, like all these events you guys had, and it seemed really fun. Did you feel that way, Lucy?
Yes and no. it's, again, very specific to the thing that neuroscience program at UBC, where you are forced, quote unquote, to take two classes, and usually everybody in their cell, same floor in your lab, they're starting the program, will be also taking those classes. So it definitely gives you much more opportunity to interact with peers, but because the course was so intense in terms of how much you had to study and all the information that you had to keep, by the end of the class, everybody was like, excuse me, goodbye. Everybody just decided to go their own way, basically. And if you're not going to see that people while you're in your lab, that community might not happen. And yeah, we have a lot of events and everything, but similar to what you said, that not all neuroscience people are in the neuroscience program, not all neuroscience people are in the same building. So all these events can also be hard to carry because you have people at iCord where they do spine research and in different facilities. So yes, it's easier to meet people from neuroscience when you are in the neuroscience program, but you still have to make a significant, I would say, amount of effort to keep those relationships. I guess, like, in life, don't expect to just be friends because you're sitting next to each other. Mm-hmm. Do try to nurture that relationship.
So that's interesting that you bring up the grad course, because as a first year, so I started my PhD in the neuroscience program, meaning because I came from a neuroscience background, I didn't have to take the course, but everyone in my, like, cohort was taking that class, so I didn't really get to know people through that class. This sort of goes back to the previous conversation about building your community and how hard that can be. I had to really like go to the pub nights. I think that's where I might have first met you, Lucy. Mm-hmm.
I think so.
Like go to the pub nights and then find people that I genuinely click with, and then, you know, like maintain those friendships. It is hard when, like Lucy mentioned, you meet people in one setting and then they sort of go off to do their own things at different buildings. You know, it's, I think you really have to seek it out and seek those friendships and connections out and also put in the work to maintain them. Like working very closely with the other co-founders and execs in NeuroSight has helped me a lot with that. I think we're pretty tight knit and grown close working together. So opportunities like that, I had to sort of go out of my way to seek out and be invested in, I guess.
I'm really excited for like seminars to be coming back or like events like that to be coming back because I always look forward to it. Actually, our lab used to be in another building, an older building, and it was just us at like two other labs there, and we're very isolated. So now we're in the main building, one of the main buildings, the DMCBH, but we were in the other building, so we wouldn't even be told about things, and posters would be put up, and people wouldn't even bother coming over to our building to put posters up about events. But I did look forward to going to things like this Friday, the data binge. I really looked forward to it because I would see people I don't see, and I would always look forward to, or you'd randomly see somebody there, or at this neuro pizza seminars that we have at UBC, and you'd see people you haven't talked to in a while. So that's kind of another example how you have to really seek it out. You have to actually go to those things And even hear, sometimes you don't even hear about them. You have to look for the information about them and seek out those opportunities. Neuroscience in general, like at many different institutions, it's very collaborative between different departments. So I feel like it's not just UBC, it's other institutions too. People are kind of separated because it's a newer field, like new as in the last 100 years or something. So it sort of combines so many different departments that you get that fragmentation. And I do know like one thing about that I'm just thinking of is that there are some people from my class that I never see anymore because they go to their weekly seminar and we have a different one. And often it's the same people that go to that one. So you do end up with these little groups, which is nice, but it's also nice to see the people from, you know, their research might be quite different than yours or, you know, whatever, but you actually might learn, you know, it might actually be good to, from a research perspective, talking to people with different research, but also getting to know more people in the program. So
I guess this is one of the advantages of enjoying SciComm is that you get to meet people through shared interests and shared projects. Maybe like that's one benefit of doing this extra labor on the side of science communication is finding your community and like-minded people.
Hi, dear listener. This is Nyla, host and co-founder here at Aminder. I've been hosting with the team since 2020, and not only has this taught me a lot about Alzheimer's disease, but I've also learned a lot about my inability to articulate words and to keep a consistent distance from the microphone. I apologize for that. But overall, it's been a really rewarding experience and one that we would love to share with you. If you'd like to take a deep dive into Alzheimer's research and science communication, then I've got good news for you. We're currently recruiting new hosts and content creators for the podcast. Just email us at aminderpodcast@gmail.com or contact us through our social media pages and tell us a little bit about yourself. Looking forward to working with you soon.
Nearly 1 million older Canadians live with a form of dementia. This number is expected to double within 10 years, and sadly no solutions exist yet to dramatically reduce these numbers. It has to stop. Research can help solve this problem. We are 350 researchers fully dedicated towards preventing and finding a cure to dementia, and to improve care to those living with dementia. We are the Canadian Consortium on Neurodegeneration and Aging. The solution to dementia could be closer than you think.
Yeah, definitely think with Aminder, we've made a really great community that we talk about on our episodes sometimes. Like-minded people that all really are interested in SciComm. Maybe we should talk a little bit about NeuroPsyched because I think Sarah and I want to hear more about NeuroPsyched and the community that you've built. So how about starting by just telling us, what is NeuroPsyched?
So NeuroPsyched is a brain science e-magazine created by UBC neuroscience graduate students with the specific sort of goal in mind to build community amongst brain scientists across Canada. So we're sort of flexible on our approach with articles. We have a couple of different sections, including scientist spotlights. So we like to always start with the graduate student spotlight and include like other trainees or visiting scientists who come to give talks at universities or just spotlight scientists and researchers both in and outside of academia just to hear about their journeys and maybe gain some insight from them. And we also have a section for general science now and knowledge translation as well as opinion pieces. So sort of just a wide breadth of different areas that people can write for. And again, the goal of this all is to be able to build community amongst readers across Canada and whoever else from across the world maybe reads our site.
Yeah, I think specifically, we hope that through the magazine, this e-magazine, people can read about areas of research that maybe they will like to work on and also see other graduate students that might be doing amazing things like most of the ones that we've had, that we've brought about have. And yeah, feel this sense of we are all kind of doing the same thing or working towards the same thing in brain sciences.
That's so cool. I mean, we're just talking about how important it was to have community and how lacking it was. It's impressive that, I mean, you identified a need within the community and you're addressing it in a way that's accessible despite the restriction posed by COVID. And I feel like a lot of the Psycho-On Love initiatives now are moving to an online format, whether it be blogs or podcasts. So I think it's kind of cool. It's something that was definitely needed. But tell us a bit more about what you do with Neuropsych, your role with it.
So I am now an editor in Neuropsych, and I also do the small managing tasks during a release or a planning meeting.
And how about you, Jen?
Yeah, so my role in Neuropsych is the website designer. So I'm responsible for sort of like uploading the articles and then making the site look all nice and pretty in the end.
I
think that... And another really important set of skills that I've learned through these experiences has also been how to work with a team. Yeah, so it involves familiarizing yourself with others' work styles, which obviously differ greatly, as well as working through conflict together without taking things personally and just keeping an end goal in mind that you want to put together the site and you're doing this for the readers to get something out of it. And so a lot more people skills than I expected, which translate really well to other scenarios in both life and at work.
Yeah, definitely. And I think tagging on what Jen said about kind of the skills that we're gaining as we're working in Neuropsych, I would agree 100% on figuring out how to work with others specifically, because we're not getting paid to do this, right? So at the end, the only reason why you want to get something done is for yourself and to respect the works of others. So kind of figuring this out at the beginning and kind of understanding how each other, like, we work as a team and how do we work separately. It's something that I feel I was lacking as a graduate student, because nobody else is working in the project for myself, right? So having to have this finished product as a team really makes you think about what does the work I'm producing is going to mean for my peers? What is this? Is this good enough for me? Is this going to be good enough for them? And again, we're not getting paid, so we don't have any economical motivation or any other sort of pressure. It does make me feel more comfortable comfortable approaching the quote unquote outside world. As somebody who doesn't want to stay in academia, I've always been very fearful of tomorrow when I go to an interview, are people going to look at me and say, this kid has never had a job in her life? And really understanding that I do have the skills, I just didn't realize it. And I can prove I have the skills because I've worked with this amazing team, and it's been easier than, it's been so much easier because they're all such hardworking people and they're all brilliant. So it's might be kind of cheating in a way to this be my first quote unquote quote work or job outside in academia, because even if we don't see it, this is sort of a job. Like the amount of hours that you put into it, they add up, and you're producing something, you're creating a product, and sometimes you have to detach yourself from the product and want to see your work as a product, as something that you want people to like and as something that you want people to read. It's been amazing to be able to work Neuropsych. First, because as you said, you create this little community with the people that you're working with. And second, because it gives you so many skills, and it makes you also realize that you are already skilled in so many ways that you as a grad student might not notice.
I love that. Do you guys have sort of similar experiences working together for Reminder?
Yeah, I really love the community that Aminder has become. Our team's quite big, because our goal of summarizing all the abstracts every month is a pretty big goal. So I feel like having the bigger team does make it a little bit more challenging to have that community. But I think we're kind of trying to improve that. But within our core team, I feel like we have a really good sense of community. And we're kind of trying to open that up to our bigger team. And I think that's a goal of the podcast too, is to also create a community online with our listeners. So we really love it when listeners shout out to us and contact us that way. As far as skills, I think, you know, I've really learned a lot about project management working on the podcast and producing the episodes. So I oversee a lot of the scheduling of the different parts that go into an episode, basically many different steps that different people fill, and I oversee the entire thing. So it's a lot of sort of juggling and like putting the puzzle pieces together, which I really enjoy. It's shown me what I like and also what I don't like, because sometimes I take on certain jobs within Aminder, and then I'm like, sometimes when you're really busy, you like what you're busy with. And sometimes when you're really busy, you're just like trying to get through it. So it can really tell you what kinds of things you enjoy and what you don't enjoy. Yeah. What do you think, Sarah?
I think we just mentioned it's just the curse of managers with a project that's, you know, voluntary, like Aminder and Neuropsyched, is that you often end up doing things you don't really enjoy doing because you have mm-hmm. to, you know, to get the project continue going. And there's small things like administrative things and asking, like checking with people if they're going to be on time, or like picking up things that people couldn't do. You have to just because no one will. And I think that's just the plight of a manager. We have people who transition sometimes from a certain role into a management role. And I recommend that they take on less of doing things to allow time for management and things that you don't foresee. Mm-hmm. And with something like this, I've learned like just to leave a margin for things you may not foresee and allow myself not to feel guilty if I'm not doing it all. And sometimes like, oh, I'm telling people to do something and I'm not doing it. But the thing is, I'm doing a lot of things behind the scenes that people don't see. There's a lot of communication. There are things that come up that you don't plan for, like when someone messages you because something is not working and they end up having a 30 or 1 hour conversation about it, trying to figure out the problem. These are things that people don't really see or plan for. And you're right, Lucy, it's all unpaid work. And I think we're all very, at least here, I think we're very privileged to be able to do this unpaid, because it is time that's coming out of time I could be working a job that makes money. And I think that's something a lot of grad students do, whether it be in SciComm or even in graduate student work, is that there's what is seen and explicit in your job. And there's the implicit stuff of like what you said, Ellen, about wiring things in the lab. And like that was not in your job description, and yet you have to do it. So, and I would imagine this is probably a barrier for some students to get into science communication, because unfortunately a lot of students have to work more than one job on the side, and sometimes the PIs are not necessarily aware of it or not open to it. So I've met people who don't say to their PI that they do SciComm on the side or that they're working another job. In terms of community, the big team in Aminder, yeah, makes it a bit tough to have a community. And we're also in different countries. Like I counted 6 different time zones. So we have people who've never met in our team, not just in person, but even virtually, because we're doing things that are very different. And some of the work we do is very self-directed. But some of the things where we'll work on a poster together for a conference, I think really, really brings us together. Mm-hmm. But I do want to like use this opportunity to highlight, yeah, like what you said, Lucy, it's unpaid work that we do because we're passionate about it. And I think a lot of scientists, that's what they do. We're passionate about what we do, and we don't think about retribution, which is beautiful in itself, but also needs to be talked about.
I don't know about you guys, but I find that like when neuropsych work gets really heavy, it always just tends to overlap with the time that lab work gets heavy. So I find myself majorly revenge procrastinating at the end of the night, because I just feel like I don't have control over my time, so I just sit there.
Revenge procrastinating. Never heard that.
What is that?
Do you ever find yourself sort of like scrolling mindlessly on social media, or just like doing things when you're not supposed to be doing them, or like when you're supposed to be sleeping and you know that you should be sleeping, but you're sitting there scrolling on your phone even if you don't necessarily want to? I don't know if I described it completely like accurately, but yeah, people have been bringing up this concept of revenge procrastination, where you just want more agency over your time. And people tend to do this when they like are overworked or like don't have control of their day. And then this sort of feeds into this vicious cycle of, okay, well, I'm not getting enough sleep, so then my next day is going to be shitty too. And there's still all this work to do. But yeah, I found myself during those times where that work overlaps, I revenge procrastinate all night.
I think, you know, there was a word for it, but
yeah. Yeah.
100%, yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah, also like Lucy, I didn't know that was there was a word for that, but that totally, now I know what to call that when I do that.
Yeah, I think I do that even with A-Minder tasks. Like, there are tasks at A-Minder that are very mindless and can take hours and hours, like design for advertising. Gee, that's not like, I can never plan for it. It sometimes takes 5 hours to design like a series of posts for Instagram. And I find that I just like indulge in that and just will spend all the hours on it just because I think, oh, this is for A-Minder, so I don't need to be guilty about it. Well, there are things that are more pressing for A-Minder that I'm procrastinating on because they are maybe more, they're not mindless tasks. So I'm like, you know, at the end of the night when I can actually dedicate time to A-Minder, I have to keep in mind, oh, if I leave this for midnight, I'm going to be exhausted. And that's what I end up doing. And I'd be exhausted and look at it like, I don't have brains for this. I'm going to go do design work instead and stay up till 4 a.m.
I do that too a little bit with like, I know I need to do something, but instead I like to, like, since I'm managing, people are contacting me on Slack a lot and I like doing that, you know, like just working things out or working out scheduling things. Like, I don't know if it's weird that I like that, but I like that sort of like figuring things out. So I know I should be working on something else, but instead I'm like staring at the schedule, just looking at it or like, you know, thinking about the next schedule when really like for the following month when really it's like way, like we don't need to think about that yet. There's like, I actually have to edit my episode still.
I was just going to say that I do that also with lab work where if I have to, I have to copy paste a bunch of data. So I'll be like, I bet I can do a code for that and I'll spend 10 hours. Well, probably not, but like I spend a good amount of time making that and trying to figure it out when I'm only going to use it once. But I'm like, I bet I can do this. And I know it's not as important and I could do it in a different way and maybe even faster, but I'm like, it's okay. It's part of my work. This is fine.
Yeah. I'm glad I'm not alone in doing that revenge procrastination.
And I love scheduling things too. Like, you're not the only one, Ellen. I love to type to
it's fun.
Arrange things like, oh, this happens first and this and this and that. I love it. It excites me so much.
I know we're talking a lot of the SciComm part and we mentioned finances, and I do want to make some time, maybe even like a few minutes, to bring this up because I think this is something on the mind of a lot of graduate students, and I've seen that online. And I think even, especially for students who do extra work like science communication or extra labor on the side that's not paid. So I want to make some time to bring that up because it's important and very toxic. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, on managing finances and time management with like lab work and SciComm initiative where you're not being paid. Perhaps you are seeking funding for this, but not necessarily pay yourself, but just to make sure that this continues. So what are your thoughts on that?
So I think the first thing I would say is if you're starting your graduate program, the first year and a half, you're going to spend it writing grants and applying for scholarships, and it's going to suck your time and you're going to get rejection after rejection, hopefully not too many times. But that's nearly the way it's supposed to be. It's strangely, it is expected from you to spend all this time doing these applications that might or might not fall through. So it can be frustrating, and then it can be very stressful when you don't have the means to even fit yourself. But yeah, I don't know what to say. I was lucky enough to, for the first year, have a scholarship from my techs, and from the second year, after applying 4 times to a scholarship from the Mexican government and getting that one, I was good to go for the rest of my PhD. So I was very stressed for sure the first year and a half, but once I got the second scholarship, it was smooth sailing. But then again, all the time that I put into that and all the stress that you feel and the uncertainty whether you're gonna be able to have money tomorrow, whether you will have money tomorrow or not, it adds up to the stress of just doing research. So I wish I had a solution, because sometimes people could say like, oh, try to save my money, try to eat less of this, more of that, try to cut expenses. But sometimes the amount of money that graduate students get paid is ridiculous. Like, I've heard of so many, because there's no rule really, like only for PhD students. I think UBC says that you have to get paid a certain amount every year. But what about master's students? They don't eat, I guess. I don't know. There's this tiny things that add up, and Yeah, I guess you just, they don't expect, and by they I mean like the universities or academia in general, doesn't expect you to have a normal life, eating food that people eat, going places people go, having a house eventually. I guess that's not something that if you stay in academia, you might be able to do as soon as other people.
Yeah.
It's very depressing, I would say. I think that's what I was trying to say. It can be very depressing and frustrating. What do you think then?
Yeah, I don't think that there's really a simple answer to that question because, again, it is unpaid work and unpaid labor and a really huge time investment. And often, actually, when I'm revenge procrastinating at the end of the night, I'm also really frustrated that I'm volunteering to do this, but it took up like half of my day on top of the super long day that I had at work. And I'm just like so tired. But here I am, revenge procrastinating, and this is going to continue on for like a week or two or however long it takes for these things to get out of the way. But I think something that I've also learned maybe more recently over the past few months, especially with our like third issue release, which was the biggest that we've, you know, had yet. So it was like a little bit more work.
Congratulations.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, we're really happy about how it turned out. I think it also sort of circles back to asking yourself why you're doing the specific activity that you're doing and how it will help you develop a certain skill that you need for your next step in your career. And then just thinking about all the things you're involved in and sort of asking yourself why you're doing them and what's most important in helping you for that next step. And then sort of having to eliminate things if it's taking up too much of your time. I think I've definitely been in a place where I've just had way too much on my plate and I've had to really sit down and think what I want to really invest my time in and what I, you know, can sacrifice. And I'm fortunate in my current position to get a full stipend for my lab and be supported by scholarships and stuff. But previously at my master's institution, you know, in the US, they actually don't give you stipends for masters. So I had to take out a loan and I was also working part-time at a cafe.
What?
And like taking classes and doing research. And it was just a lot, you know. And I think I realized it a lot then as well that I had to sort of cut down on my involvement on things if they weren't helping me get to the next step. Because I have this, it's sort of a, I think I take on too much a lot because I'm interested in a lot of things. So I'll just like dabble in everything. But sometimes, like while that can be helpful, it can hurt you as well if you just really don't have time to do all of it. So that's a very long-winded answer, but I think it really comes down to prioritizing what's going to help you and what's not.
I think definitely when you're economically stretched, there's less time for you to do the things that will make you grow in different ways. Like, I am very lucky that I have the scholarship that I have, but I see people, like one of my previous roommates, he was a master's student and he was also a need to eat because he wasn't very paid enough. So he wouldn't have time to do something like this. I think also coming, because my previous roommate, he was also Mexican and I'm Mexican. I think coming from somewhere where the peso is worth so much less than the Canadian dollar, I thought, oh, I'm going to have so much money. Like, this is going to be super easy, smooth sailing, but they're going to pay me just so much. And then you get here and it's like, oh, okay, yeah, no, this is not enough. So I guess also keep in mind that from wherever you're coming from, if you're moving to a different country and you're going, whatever you're going to pay is a lot, it might not. And also necessities and financial needs change as you grow. And when you start your PhD, you might not feel like you need as much money. But for example, now that I have a partner that I'm thinking of starting a family, buying a house, all these things, that seems impossible with the amount of money that I'm earning right now. And it's like, I've hit a point where, because I don't have a normal job, I'm not going to get a raise after 5 years of working here or after 5 years of giving my time to do this research, right? So your financial needs will change throughout your career. And that's something to keep in mind as you apply for grants and as you decide what the next step is. Because today, your first year of PhD, you might think, oh, I'm good. But like a fifth year, your necessities are going to be different. And that's something that I never thought about when I was starting my degree. So.
Yeah, and not just from other countries, but even other parts of Canada. I mean, I've seen graduate students look at the stipend and think, oh, with this, I can definitely live a decent life in a different city in Canada, right? By moving into Vancouver, the rent takes up half, even 75% of your stipend. And it's something a lot of people don't think about because financial literacy is not great. When you're applying to graduate school, you're not necessarily thinking about your finances that way. I know for me, I just thought, like, I'm getting stipend for volunteering in a lab because I didn't think of it as a job. But it kind of was, because if you're spending years, like 5-7 years in graduate school, during that time, not only are you making small wage, but also losing earning potential during that time, which your peers who followed a different path, they're already maybe thinking about retirement or mortgages. Well, for me, I'm not going to think about that until 10 years from now. And then am I going to make an income that's going to allow me to catch up, right? And I was looking at postdoc salaries and thinking, maybe not, unless I have 2 or 3 different jobs. So that definitely makes you think about volunteering on the side, like for science communication, other things that are really needed in science academic community, makes you think about it a bit differently. I don't know. How about you, Ellen?
I'm just thinking about the point about postdoc salaries. And I mean, I agree with all the points. Like, I feel like I've just gotten used to being, you know, not having very much money or, you know, like volunteering a lot. So being a student for like 10 years now, it's almost like where you get used to it at a certain point. And then I was talking to somebody about postdoc and how I'm going to be done school. And I was talking about how much postdocs make. And they were like, what? I thought you'd be making loads of money after being done school. And I'm like, no, I mean, it depends. But yeah, it's different than other career tracks for sure. And also on Jen's point about time management, one thing that I think, you know, being in grad school and also, you know, doing other projects like SciComm projects on the side, it does really make you, it's something I'm still working on and not taking too many things on, but it does allow you to focus on, you know, you have to choose the things that you really want to focus your time on. And you have to learn to say no to other things. As much as you're interested in so many things, or that's my experience for myself, you don't really have the capacity to actually do them all. So you really have to, like, know your why for being involved in those projects. And I also noticed that since I've done that and I've kind of cut away things that I weren't serving me anymore, I really can put myself fully into, you know, be fully committed to the things that I am involved in, like eMinder, instead of kind of stretching myself between like 10 different things and not really being involved fully in any of them and being like distracted and thinking about, you know, the other thing when I'm doing one of them. Or still happens though, I still like take too much on. And even within eMinder, I think I get too optimistic about how much time I'm going to have and then end up doing things at the last minute. So
Do you bring that into the lab, like saying no to things that are not going to help you in your career when your PI asks you? Like, does that happen that your PI asks you to do things that are not going to help you, are going to take your time? Like, do you say no? Do you feel comfortable saying no?
I think my supervisor, I wouldn't say she asks me things that wouldn't help with my career. But she's focused on my research mostly. And so I don't think I have the experience of her that I could think of like right on the spot right now asking me something that wouldn't, that I feel like wouldn't align with, you know, what I want to do. But if she did, I feel like I would have a hard time. Or even if someone else in the lab asked me, you know, I think I would have a harder time kind of just saying no. Yeah, it would be harder, I guess, than things outside of academia.
I agree with that. I don't think there's been many times for any that I can remember where I've been asked to do something that I wouldn't add to my degree or to my thesis. But yeah, if I were asked to do something, I was asked to do something, I would definitely not say no. Like, I'm 100% sure I wouldn't say no.
It took me some time to think about whether or not something's going to help me. Like, I would say yes right away because I always felt like, oh, mentoring all these volunteers is like for the greater good, even if they're here for a week only. While if they're there for a week, I'm training them the whole week and then they leave. And then like, I'm kind of screwed because I'm behind by a week now. And I've heard PhD students feel very resentful about writing grant applications that they're not going to benefit from. But like, you know, I'm spending 30 hours this week on this grant application. None of it is going into my salary. And if it does, my salary is not going to be increased by it. Or even like writing scholarship applications, when someone gets like a full stipend from salary, the question is, oh, should that top up what the lab is going to give me or should it replace it? Then why should I spend time applying if it's just going to replace it? And then with time, I've learned to, I wouldn't say no. I would just tell my PI, I can do that, but here's a list of stuff I have to do. Tell me what I should take out to make room for what you're asking me to do. And you will like right away realize like, oh, you know what? No, this is no longer a priority. Actually, what I just asked you is actually not a priority. So you can focus on what you have. So towards the end, but I think because I was also a technician, I was doing things for the lab rather than for my master's. It was easier because I was doing things he told me to do. So I'd show him my to-do list and say, this is going to take this much time. What you're asking me to do is going to have to replace that. Are you okay with it? And he'd be like, himself would say no. But I stopped taking in students to mentor at some point, unless they're going to stay for a long time. So whenever he asked me, like, can you teach the student? I'd be like, I'm sorry, I don't have the time unless you want me to push this project later. And then he would say, no, actually, don't do that. Because they don't realize how much time it takes to teach a student. And I had to learn to balance things. I love teaching and I love to do it well. But sometimes if it's going to come at the cost of my deadlines, I just have to say no.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, what you mentioned about sort of laying it all out and talking to your PI about sort of the workload that you have. That's something that I've definitely learned to do. Especially being in a new lab, it's a bit more challenging because the lab is not funded as like a more senior lab would be. So you're always like pushing for more grant applications, which means you need more data and figures, and everyone basically, like, at least all the senior people in the lab are involved very heavily with that. But that's a lot of work and time that maybe like, you know, for a grad student might not necessarily contribute to them graduating. And I think that the strategy of sort of laying everything out and going to your advisor and being like, oh, okay, I'm involved with all of these little things, but my end goal is to graduate, and sort of refining your research aims to sort of either incorporate that data if you can, or using that in a way to eliminate things that you don't necessarily need to be involved on. I think that's super important. And again, obviously really challenging in a new lab because sometimes you just really do need all hands on deck. But I think one thing that's really helped sort of navigate that situation in a new lab is that my PI, Annie, is super supportive. I think I mentioned this earlier when we talked about mentorship, but she's very supportive in meeting you halfway. And that's one thing that I've also learned, because I was honestly scared to be like, hey, this is too much work, or like, this is like too much. But she's very open to sort of meeting you halfway, so I'm lucky in that sense. On top of laying out everything you're involved in, I think another really good strategy is to have tangible outcomes out of it. So either being able to tie it back into your thesis so that it contributes to your progress in graduating, or just talking to your supervisor about authorship on the papers that come out of that work. And again, like, my PI is super supportive in that, and she'll actually bring that up first during our meeting and be like, of course, you know, like, you'll get authorship on this for this. So I think, yes, definitely been in that situation, but there are also ways to navigate it if you're able to like strategize your way through it. Mm-hmm. Be sure that it's helping you and not hurting your progress.
Yeah. There should be a course on advocating for yourself as a grad.
Yes, there should be.
I agree. And what you just said, Jen, about tangible outcomes, that really speaks to me, because when I was applying to medical school and we're filling our applications, when I had my CV, I saw that some of my peers had all these like awards and things that they sought out to put as a tangible proof of what they've achieved. So for me, I never really thought of doing that. I just do things because I was like, oh, this is going to help this person. This is going to be good. And I love that mindset. But in academia, sometimes you have to make sure that whatever you put your time towards is something you can show later, because it's a very competitive environment, unfortunately. And I really hope that SciComm initiatives like, you know, Neuropsych or our podcast, one day we'll have, you know, a similar recognition as a published paper, you know, or a peer-reviewed publication or a poster, or because then at the end, we are getting something out there and putting a lot of time into quality work that's going to help people. And I think we're getting there, you know, like SciComm is starting to get more recognition, and hopefully there will be jobs. If someone doesn't want to stay in academia, perhaps like there'll be more opportunities nowadays for SciComm or project management that take advantage of the skills that we are developing now.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think there are going to be more jobs available. One, just because social media is such a big thing now. So a lot of companies even just hire people to do their social media, like science companies or universities. Also, I think science communication is so important. Like, I guess a little bit different than what we do with the podcast, but SciComm to the general public is important because of all the misinformation, again, on the internet. So I think that SciComm, it's becoming, you know, I've seen more and more SciComm things, you know, like actual university courses on science communication and online workshops, conferences. So people are seeing the importance of communicating science rather than just doing science and communicating with each other about it in our sciencey language. So it's exciting. It's really exciting. We're getting near the end of our time together. And I just wanted to make sure listeners know where they can find NeuroPsyched. So where can listeners find you if they want to check out your magazine?
You can find us at neuropsyched.ca. So NeuroPsyched.ca.
Yeah, and you can also find us on Twitter and on Instagram. And our handle is neuropsyched_ca for both.
And we'll include those in the show notes as well for listeners. So you can find them there as well. So thank you guys so much for joining today. It was a really great conversation with all three of you, with Sarah, Lucy, and Jen. Really enjoyed all, I think, really great advice for listeners that are thinking about grad school or in grad school already. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having us, guys. It was so much fun, and it's tons of fun to be here, and I hope it will be also very fun to listen to.
Yeah, it was really fun and a very different thing that I'm used to. I'm not used to hearing my voice either. So this was really interesting and fun and just nice getting to know you guys too.
Likewise. And thank you for being so raw and spontaneous today. I know like we've reached on quite a few topics in grad school, but I realized we have like diverse experiences, and I've learned just listening from you today on like what I could have done, but you know, I'm gonna carry that with me for future interviews and future prospects. So thank you so much for sharing your wisdom.
I sincerely hoped you enjoyed listening to our episode with NeuroPsyched, learned something new, and maybe even related to some of the things we talked about. Revenge procrastinating, anyone? And I definitely recommend you check out NeuroPsyched magazine. You can find them at neuropsyched.ca or on Twitter and Instagram. In the latest issue, which is the November issue at the time that this is currently being recorded, two of A-Minder's very own volunteers, Glory Nasseri and Joseph Liang, both have articles. So definitely check that out. Please reach out to us by email or on social media if you like the episode or if you have any feedback or you want to continue the conversation. We'd love to hear from our listeners, and we would really like to hear what you think about this episode, which, as you know, is something different from our regular routine here. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you can also email us at aminderpodcast@gmail.com. And another way you can help us out here at Aminder is by leaving us a review wherever you listen to the show. Specifically, Apple Podcasts and Spotify both allow you to rate and review us now. And this would really help us to reach new listeners who would really benefit from the show. Big thank you to Sarah, Lucy, and Jen for joining me for this special episode of A-Minder, and to Sarah as well for helping me edit the episode. And a big thank you to you for listening today and for being a part of our A-Minder community. We couldn't do it without you, and it means a lot. I hope to talk to you again soon. Goodbye.